Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Here we are at KHOI Radio. This is community radio. We're glad you are with us. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Yes, support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op. And also, the Donald on a Kitchen Show is supported by Farm to Folk, an Ames-based food cooperative supporting farmers and bringing local farm produce and meats throughout the fall and winter. Information on a la carte buying options are available at farmtofolk.com.
This is the Donald on a Kitchen, and we are thinking about feeding ourselves around this kitchen table. We're moving out of the hot and heavy vegetable season. We are moving into fall.
It's still hot out there. I don't know what is going on here.
Well, yes, we did. I did have a bit of a frost,
and one night only.
Yeah, and I harvested the last of my zinnias, so I had this burst of color left on my kitchen counter. But at my farm, things are looking a little bit sort of frosty. Yes, they are. But October has surprised us with some really warm summers.
Yeah, you could have been out in your bathing suit yesterday.
Just about, if you could swat the mosquitoes.
Yeah, didn't get the mosquitoes, did it?
Hot? Not yet. Here's a little thought for October. October's child is born for woe, and life's vicissitudes must know, but lay an opal on her breast, and hope will lull those woes to rest. Ooh, that's a little bummer sort of poem there, but that's a little poem for October. The weather lore of October states that the more bright red berries, haws and hips and things like that, that can be seen in the hedgerows, the more frost and snow there will be in the forthcoming winter. But while we're thinking of that, October is noted for its second summer in many lands of the Northern Hemisphere. Here we call it Indian summer, kind of going along with the fact that Christopher Columbus screwed up, and no, this isn't India, but we still call it India summer. In Sweden, it's called St. Bridget summer. In Italy, it's called the summer of St. Teresa. Germany and Switzerland, it's the summer of St. Gall. And in England, it's St. Luke's summer. So I hope everybody in those Northern Hemisphere countries are also having nice weather before the winter hits. Yes. October thoughts.
It's sort of feeling like the endless summer right now. Although, finally, there's a few leaves falling.
And you can kind of look up and say, that's what those trees are going to look like. They are really getting pretty.
I wonder if it's not going to just go really fast all of a sudden.
That can happen.
Yeah.
That can happen. Driving into the station today, I did notice some pretty leaves, pretty trees. Yes. So today we're going to be talking about accordions. Yeah, accordion music. Because Oktoberfest is coming up, we'll consider beer and Oktoberfest.
Yep,
and
we're going to have a big celebration in downtown Ames. I am really looking forward to this. We're going to have a polka band, and we're going to have lots of beers. What could be more exciting?
That's great.
The weather will still stay nice for it.
That's great. I have a little bit of information here on the accordion. The invention of the accordion, as it was named in the patent granted to a man named Cyril Demian in 1829. That's relatively recent. I mean, 1829, there was a musical explosion. He came up with this idea of a sort of a one-man band kind of thing. He engineered supposedly the first accordion in 1829. But
there must have been squeeze boxes before that.
Not really.
Really?
There were organs, you know, and things. And of course, like anything else, it was derided as the instrument of the devil. Because, of course, Young men would grab onto it. You could make all kinds of noise. You could get people dancing. A newspaper article of 1840 described the accordion as the instrument with which youth entertained themselves in the street, and also referred to as a torture instrument for those that did not like the noise that it made. And then everybody kind of jumped on this bandwagon. People like to dance. People like to have a good time. The accordion is a loud instrument. It accompanies itself. Also, there's chords and there's the melody. And so...
Right. This was before electronic amplification.
Right. And so it quickly spread all over the place from Vienna, and lots of different manufacturers got in on it. It was really big in the United States. A lot of people grabbed onto it. And then in 1830, a man named Wheatstone invented the concertina, which was kind of a different bent on that.
The smaller version.
Smaller. And that was also one note at a time as opposed to the whole. But anyway, that turned out to be a real popular sort of instrument. There were concertina bands. There were accordion bands. And business was booming. And it was... The concertina was an expensive luxury item, so of course all the best houses, even the young ladies were encouraged to play the concertina. But as the accordion craze got bigger and bigger, cheap instruments came out, more people could afford them, and of course everything was kind of looked down on then. But we still love the accordion, and this is Oktoberfest, so we'll think of accordion
music. I believe Lana still has her father's accordion, right?
I have an old Hohner accordion, diatonic accordion from my dad, and I can play a couple waltzes on it. And why not? It's just a really fun instrument. I like it because you can wear it on your belly and you kind of breathe along with it. It's a real tricky sort of thing to play, but well worth the effort. Three cheers to the guy who invented the accordion. And we'll hear some accordion music later. Also, today on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we'll hear an interview with Dr. Robert Wallace about big meat and the health consequence.
Big Farm makes big flu. It's Dr. Robert Wallace. He is an evolutionary biologist.
Very good.
So we had a nice interview. He was in town, spoke at the library last week. And Evan, play us the interview. This is Donna Prisgintas, and we have a very exciting interview. Rob Wallace is here. He has been in Ames speaking at the library about his book called Big Farms Make Big Flu. And Rob, who lives in the Twin Cities, is an evolutionary biologist.
That's correct.
And he also, his other book, which is more straight for scientists, but I have to read you the title. It's fascinating. It's called Neoliberal Ebola. Mm-hmm. Got that, folks? Neoliberal Ebola, the subtitle is Modeling Disease Emergence from Finance to Forest and Farm. So you get this one, and the one that I'm going to be reading, probably stay up all night and read it tonight, right? Big Farms Make Big Flu, Dispatches on Infectious Diseases, Agribusiness, and the Nature of Science.
Right.
Now, Rob, why would you be interested in getting your message across in Ames, Iowa?
Well, Iowa, of course, is a epicenter of...
Epicenter. I call it the belly of the beast.
Belly of the beast. Epicenter certainly has a connotation as well of agribusiness.
Mm-hmm.
And my...
We're in the middle of the middle of the middle here.
We are, very mm-hmm. much so. And it is, in my view, agribusiness economic model is one of the driving forces of the emergence and spread of deadly pathogens.
All right. Let me reiterate that, because this is quite serious. Agribusiness, which is our main industry here, is the main driver of
the evolution of deadly pathogens and many pathogens, not only
like the bird flu that everybody's worried about the MRSA that none of us even know enough about.
Yes, there's a whole bunch of other ones.
Okay,
as well.
So what does an evolutionary biologist do that you can write this big book?
Yeah, well, it is interesting how an evolutionary biologist ends up making such a declaration about agribusiness. Typically, we're involved in just looking at organisms and populations and tracking how they change in time and space.
Well, you must have seen something in those studies that triggered all this.
Well, yeah. Well, I was a postdoc working with Walter Fitch, one of the fathers of molecular phylogeny in University of California, Irvine, and we were looking at the genetic sequences of influenza H5N1. That's the bird flu that everyone was freaking out about in the aughts, right?
Quite prominent around
yes,
here.
Yes, absolutely. And we produce what was called a phylogeography, and that is we took the genetic
sequences. Phylogeography.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
We took genetic sequences of the different samples of influenza.
And this was all certainly not last year when this all just happened here.
No. This is H5N1. That happened in China. H5N2 is the influenza that happened here in the Midwest last year, and we'll get to that in due course.
Okay.
Because these things are in some ways very much connected other than just their names. So we were able to make a family tree based on these genetic sequences, and because we know the locales of the sequences, we were able to infer how the H5N1 strain spread out of southern China across Eurasia, and
this is
into
the wild bird theory?
Wild birds were important of that spread. However, they weren't the only things going on. You might have, say, H5N1 may have gone on by goose from southern China to Lake Qinghai, just south of Mongolia. By wild waterfowl, by geese, and then maybe hopped on a poultry train across Russia. Multiple modes of transmission and transport. In the course of doing this, I have the unfortunate problem of being curious. It's a real problem.
And I suppose you think out of the box. That's just terrible.
Well, yeah, it is. Well, so I got curious, and I wanted to know why H5N1 emerged in the southern province of Guangdong in 1997. And if you can look at the genetic sequences all day, and they don't tell you anything about that. You can't find the answer to that. So I got interested in kind of the economic geography of agriculture in the region. I got interested.
So you stepped out of your evolutionary biology role.
Oh, yeah, boy. That was a mistake, let me tell
you. You've got an unsiloed thinker here. Well, this could be dangerous.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a lot of discussion among academia and researchers of all stripes of interdisciplinarity, but to actually practice it is a dangerous professional step.
This could cost you your job.
I would say it did. But I learned so much along the way. I mean, you learn how China became something of an epicenter of multiple influenzas. You learn about the history of Chinese agriculture. You learn about how they began cultivating rice in the Neolithic and then introduced ducks into the rice paddies in the early imperial period. And then with the return of capitalism in China, they put a third layer of intensive poultry. And so it becomes a perfect storm of circumstances of influenzas that typically circulate among wild ducks and wild geese can spill over into intensive poultry, and then the virulence of the influenza can be ramped up in that environment. And we can talk about more why that's the case in a second. And then from there, blow out onto humans.
So are you going to explain to us how we got it in Iowa and Minnesota and if it's going to come back again?
Oh, well, I don't make kind of predictions like that. My thought about it is that it will come out again somewhere else because we're doing just about nothing to intervene and interrupt the mechanisms by which multiple influenzas are now circulating.
And do we know how to intervene?
I would say we do, but we pretend we don't. We have to pretend we don't because we need to save the agribusiness economic model. That's the most important thing.
Whoa, them's fighting words.
They are fighting words.
Tell us about this.
All right, well, let me take a step back. How is it that, for decades, we, among humans, we only had a number of human influenzas, H1, H2, H3. Those are the seasonal influenzas that we get our vaccines for once a year, or some of us do. And all of a sudden, in the last couple decades, we had a surge of new influenzas emerging out of intensive poultry and intensive hog that are capable of infecting humans. And we're getting ourselves into the world of H5s, H6s, H7s, H9s.
And where does MRSA fit into that?
Well, MRSA is more of a bacterial thing. It's, but they're not disconnected for tangential reasons, but maybe we can return to that. But the influenzas are diversifying, and we do not have the immunity both at the individual level and the population level, and the vaccines are late in coming. So
they're outmaneuvering us as a human species.
They are outmaneuvering us, but we are allowing them. We are providing the means and modes by which to outmaneuver us. And the way it comes about is two things. From the viewpoint of a pathogen, you don't want to be too much of a badass, because if you infect
your host
and you kill your host too fast, you have to...
And all of the host's relatives and... Yeah.
Well, if you kill your host too fast, then you can't get into the next host because you killed your host too fast. So they have to be...
stop moving around because he's dead,
he's
right?
He's dead, and so he can't... You can't infect the next host in the lineage there. So there's a cap on how virulent you can be typically. But if you are able, if you put 15,000 turkeys in a barn or 250,000 layers in a barn and you put a virus in there, well, all the turkeys are there or all the chickens are there and they're able to spread and not have to worry about there being a cap on how virulent you are, because the next host is right there.
Well, but when you've killed the whole flock, then what happens?
Well, once you've killed the barn, then you have, in essence, develop a kind of quorum by which you can infect the next barn. You have as many birds that are infected, that puts you in the position to be able to infect other barns, other farms. Some birds, some of the strains don't really produce symptoms until latent in the infection.
So they've gotten out and about.
Yeah, you get out and about by traveling, by transport. So that's one aspect of how the agribusiness economic model has helped select for these virulence in these strains. There's the other aspect is that the commodity chains are expanding across the globe. And they're going much farther and faster.
Oh, you mean like processed poultry going to China?
There is processed poultry, but in addition, live birds, live poultry, live hog. In fact, there's up in Manitoba a couple of years ago was a story about how bred hog, especially bred hog, were transported by plane from Manitoba to Germany and then trucked up into Russia, Krasnodar. So in essence,
for like, what happened to artificial insemination? That could be a little more foolproof.
That you would imagine that's the case, but that's not always the practice. And so in essence, this whole notion that pigs don't fly is actually incorrect. They do. They take they take planes at this point. In fact, there's stories.
I bet they go first class. These guys.
Yeah. Well. And so what does it have to do with influenza? Well, the fact of the matter is that historically, the influenza genome is segmented. It's made of multiple segments. And influenzas, if you have two different influenzas and you infect one bird or one hog, they can trade their segments like card players on a Saturday night. And so that increases the diversity.
Very clever.
Yes, very clever.
Wow.
Then. And so increases the evolutionary rate by which these influenzas can converge on wonderfully deadly and infectious pathogens.
Or this is strains. How they can outmaneuver human beings.
Yes. And so what we've done in the course of expanding the commodity chain from one side of the planet to the other is that influenza subtypes that were previously isolated from each other are now coming together in ways that they hadn't previously. And you can see that in the genome of the swine flu from 2009. That was H1N1, if you remember, it emerged out of Mexico and then subsequently went human to human and spread all around the world. Well, we were very lucky that it wasn't very virulent, although it killed a whole bunch of people along the way quite quietly. But if you look at its genome, you'll see that several of its segments are from influenzas that were circulating among hogs in North America. Several of the segments were circulating among hog in Eurasia, and some of them were among the traditional recombinant.
So let me get this right.
Yeah.
The hog viruses stay in the hogs.
Hmm?
The poultry viruses stay in birds, but all kinds of birds, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose cows have their own, and or do mm-hmm. they pass them like the mammals get their own, uh-huh. or how does that work?
Well, that's a very good question. The fact of the matter is it's becoming a lot more traffic across the different taxa. So, for
so
instance,
a cow can pass it to a deer.
You could, but typically, for the most part, there are a lot more poultry and hog, and there's being transported from one side of the planet to the other in ways that that some of the other animals aren't.
Because the cows are usually dead when we're carrying them around, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. So there's another example there in which the structure of the agricultural sector is intimately related to the evolution of the virus.
Mm-hmm. So we humans have done this to ourselves.
Yes, exactly.
That's through our greedy genes, right?
Right.
I was just teasing Rob before the show. I happened to listen to some Stephen Hawking, which I've been avoiding because he's saying that, you know, Stephen Hawking, the famous mm-hmm. Stephen Hawking, is saying that kind of we've screwed up the environment so badly that it's time to really start to think about living on Mars. And Stephen Hawking is attributing this to the greedy gene in human beings.
You know, I like Stephen Hawking in a lot of things, but not on this thing. I think he's dead wrong on this thing.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so, because I'm not going to Mars.
Yeah.
I'm going down with the ship.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, though, is that despite the
maybe it's the stupid gene instead of the greedy gene.
Well, I think of it as a stupid system, but that's another thing. I mean, you know, though I
yeah, but we made the system. This is a human-made system.
This is true, but we can certainly make other systems as well. In fact, in the book, I describe other practices. Look at that.
All right, so tell us then about a kinder, gentler system that we need to create.
Well, there are multiple systems around the world. You know, there is another world is possible, and it's already on its way, really. There are.
We like the good news.
Yeah.
Keep it coming, Rob. What
well,
do we do? What
yeah,
do
well,
we
there
do?
Are there are systems of agricultural production that are disconnected or not led by agribusiness model. There are.
Well, is this like Lana and I have wondered during this whole bird flu thing?
Mm-hmm.
How come all of us with little backyard flocks haven't been affected?
Okay. Now, see, I was going to talk about H5N2. I can do that now, or we could go for the good news first.
You choose. Okay.
How about this? Why don't we do more bad news and then end on a wonderful
okay.
note?
Okay. All right. Okay. It's all yours.
All right. Let's do that. Let's start. Okay. H5N2, right? So I had H5N1. I talked about H1N1 2009 swine flu. And now we have the H5N2, which happened last year, which really.
Okay, that's the Iowa one, right?
That's the Iowa,
okay.
Minnesota,
okay,
Iowa
okay,
one,
okay,
right?
Okay.
And they really.
It's in our backyard.
That's
okay.
Right, exactly. And but not in your backyard, because you have backyard birds
right.
that didn't suffer that, right?
No, I don't have I have no CAFOs or confinement operations in my backyard.
That's right. So you see, I've been studying this for like 10 years and a lot of attention on what was going on in China and Indonesia and places like that. So when it happened here in H5N2 emerged here, it was it's not funny because it's a terrible thing.
You have 50 million birds. Did you say, I told you so to a lot of people that, you know?
Well, yeah, but, you know, that's the thing. You should see the extent to which industry scientists, and I'm talking not just at Hormel or Cargill, but also at the University of Minnesota where I work. Because many of the scientists there, particularly in the animal science division, the vets, vet med, are paid by Hormel and other
mm-hmm,
companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in essence, they went to extraordinary lengths to blame everything but what was right in front of them. Because you're absolutely correct. For H5N2, the outbreaks were almost exclusively on in industrial barns. In industrial farms.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't
big
think...
Big ones.
Yeah, huge ones. We're
millions
talking,
of
millions
dead
of birds.
It was just horrible.
Yeah, and some of them, a lot of the birds were culled in attempt to control, but many of the birds were killed outright by the virus.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first barn that was Yeah, 99% of the birds killed, and the another barn was just completely wiped out by the virus itself. So you have like 15,000 turkeys killed by the virus, and I mean, it really speaks to how deadly. And so the industrial scientists went through all sorts of lengths to blame everything else. And I've seen this before; it's ridiculous.
The stuff in the press. I mean, from a lay person's perspective, I mean, I'm just a little cook, you know. Mm. It made no sense at all to
right.
me.
Right.
Okay, Rob, we're going to have a little station break here, and when we come back, we're going to get the good news, okay?
You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was the Kasak Polka, a polka from Finland. We are celebrating the accordion today. And, folks, that was a golden oldie. I'm taking the music today from a recording of accordions all over the world, recorded between 1927 and 1948. So people have been having a good time with accordions for a long time. Now we're going to go back to an interview with Dr. Robert Wallace, talking about animals, meat, and health.
All right. We are back here with Rob Wallace, the author of Big Farms Make Big Flu. And Rob is an evolutionary biologist, a very curious evolutionary biologist, who has some interesting things to point out to us in case we're interested in evolving as a species. So
yes.
Tell us the good news, Rob.
Well, the good news is I think there's many examples from around the world of people practicing agriculture in different ways, and and also practicing at scale. I think the example that immediately comes to mind.
What do you mean by at scale, then?
Okay, well, at scale is that typically there's a lot of emphasis now, particularly here in the States and other industrial countries.
Get bigger, get out.
Right, the notion now that if you want to do good farming, you have to do it at small scale and organic style, and I, and there's a lot to be said for that. But there are, and the worry and the big knock against organic farming is that, well, you can't scale up and produce enough food to feed people. And,
well, that's actually not true and has been proven.
Yes.
However,
what I'm getting at.
Yes,
that's
okay.
My point. There are examples. I mean, one of the reasons we can't do that here is because in the subsidy structures and the regulation system.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with farming growing plants at all.
Exactly. And I think the international examples are amazing because people are allowed, are capable, and have been allowed to by their governments to scale up. I think the example that comes to mind is there's a farm cooperative in Niger of 62,000 farmers, 60% women.
Cooperative. Did you get that word?
Exactly.
Cooperative.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're producing food that feeds millions. And they have everything from community radio tool sheds available for people to just take the tools they need. They have classes on how to farm.
Are they growing chickens?
That's a very good question. I don't know that. That's a
very
good point.
What are they doing for proteins?
Those are excellent questions. I don't have the answer to, and it's terrible. I wish I did. But those are terrific follow-up questions, and I think what you're getting at here is that there are other ways of doing it, and there are other ways of producing at scale, and there are other ways, and we have much to learn from the rest of the world. And because I think we have fallen off, even those of us of like mind in terms of that we can produce food in a different way, you know, it's as if we have fallen off our understanding of what would an alternate food landscape look like.
Well, you know, we're not allowed to think about that because we have a huge vested interest in the current one, which is not serving us very well.
Right, right. And I think that's to get back to the H5N2. Mm-hmm. I think it was a clear example of that because I gave talks in Minneapolis about it and people showed up. And you can see there was a kind of a clarity of understanding that wasn't, in my view, around previously. It's not that people didn't understand, but it's like H5N2, you kill 50 million birds. It's in the industrial birds. It's not in the backyard.
Yeah. What is not working for us here?
Right, exactly. This isn't working. And what happened is that the companies know this. They know it doesn't work.
That's a big loss to take.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, it's worse for the individual farmer, but it's not good business.
Well, it's not good business. However, the thing is, among us foodies and organic folk, we talk about vertically integrated agribusiness, meaning they own everything from the fertilizer up to distribution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there was a book by Christopher Leonard. He's a Wall Street Journal reporter. It's in which he describes that actually that's not quite true. Agribusiness.
What's the name of the book?
It's called The Meat Racket.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he talks about how actually for decades, agribusiness companies own everything but one aspect of the commodity chain, and that is the actual growing out of the birds.
Yeah, they need some nice peasant farmers
right,
to do
so
that.
Right, so why do they do contract farming? Well, it turns out they know very well that if you grow 15,000 turkeys in a barn, a lot of them are going to get sick, not only from disease but stress morbidities. So why would you take that loss? Why would you allow that loss on your balance sheet when you can externalize it?
When you get these nice,
you get the farmers
naive farmers to do it, yeah.
Right. So the farmers are on the hook for $1 million mortgages to build the mm-hmm, barns mm-hmm. as specified by the companies. The farmers don't own the birds. They don't own the feed.
And they can't control the cost of any of those.
No, it's totally out of their hands.
Mm-hmm.
But that was done on purpose. And so when H5N2 came and wiped out all those birds, who was on the hook for the damage?
Dum-da-dum-dum.
Yeah. So you got the contract farmers who were on the hook for
the barns.
For the birds that were killed outright by the virus. And then for the birds that had to be culled afterwards, it was the federal government who picked up the bill, so the taxpayer.
Of course.
So here, you have an outbreak. It's a perfect example of this. And as it's happening, and this is not too long after I read Leonard's book, it was a perfect example of a way that the agribusiness model would not survive if it had to pay the cost of the
mm-hmm.
damage that it produced.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you were to internalize all that damage, whether it's the damage to the farmers, whether it's to the livestock, whether it's to the public health, you know, the emergence of antibiotic resistance, whether it's the pollution.
It's going to be expensive at some point.
Right. If you return those costs onto the agribusiness balance sheet, then we would end agribusiness as we know it.
Well, maybe we wouldn't have cheap food.
Well, that's not true either. God, I mean, so much to unpack, isn't there? Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you're presented with these slogans mm-hmm. that have no backing whatsoever, and there's considerable evidence in the other direction that this is costing us a lot of money, as it is. Doing it this way, so-called cheap food, mm-hmm. as you know, isn't cheap. But in addition, it's all the subsidy structures, all the regulation. You can produce organic food in an ecological way, in an agroecological way, at scale, in a way that people can afford it.
Yes. That's the good news, right?
That is the good news.
Okay. And this is in your book.
Yes, it is.
There's hope.
There is hope.
So what do we do?
Well, that's a very good question because in the end, really, I mean, part of it is trying to figure out, well, what would an alternate food landscape look like? How would you produce?
Well, I mean, obviously, okay, I'm almost 70 years old. I have spent my entire adult life avoiding, as a chef.
Yes.
And on a personal level, too, avoiding food from the big agricultural, yes. industrial model.
Yes.
I'm telling you, I am a really good contortionist.
Yes.
And I do, you know, have to really keep on top of a lot of these things. But what else can you do besides personally avoid? I'm aware that my buying habits are not going to get us out of this problem.
Yeah, well, I think that's an important point. That
I'm sorry. I know that Michael Pollan thinks it's a big deal, but
no,
you know what? I've been doing this a long time, and it hasn't made any difference.
I agree. And the large agribusiness knows that, too. They were scared of organic and then just bought up all their organic companies. If you want to look at it, Liz, Michigan State's Phil Howard has these wonderful concept maps showing all the organic companies and what agribusiness owns them.
Mm-hmm.
And you should look them up online. They're quite eye-opening. And you realize that the country's splitting, right? Got 1%. The 1%, they're rich. And then the rest of the country, we're getting poorer. The food system's the same way. So you have organics for people who can afford them and processed crap for the rest of us. And so the agribusiness companies have responded to that. They continue to produce processed crap for most of the country, and now they have the whole of the organic companies and are providing that. So they're not hurt by the organic market.
Oh, heavens no.
They're
going to make money no matter. Okay, now put this in an international, global perspective, because sometimes when we step out of the myopic American global domination view, sometimes there are other stories going on in other places.
Yeah. Well, you know, the example of the Nigeria cooperative is telling, but this happens everywhere. I have examples in the books of there's a Hawaiian agroforestry cooperative in which they have a third of their money goes to they do forestry, but they also protect the forest. And they also used some of the money to help the people of the cooperative. And I mean, in essence, what we're getting back to is the notion of the commons, of a shared commons.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I think people around the world understand this. And in this country and other the industrial countries, we've kind of lost our way on that. And it's something that I think we need to return to.
I recently was working with a professor in the art and design project in the school. He was talking about food and foraging and stuff like that. He brought up he turned the word commons into a verb, commoning.
Hmm.
I really, really liked that idea of feeling, yes, the commons are something, but it's also an active thing that we can participate in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. But the thing is, how do we get there? And I think that was your question.
Yeah.
And part of it is, I agree with you. I mean, I'm not opposed to people making economic decisions or, you know, budgetary decisions about what they want to pay for. That's great.
No, I mean, you know, that's the least we can do.
It's the least we can do, exactly. Yeah. But in the end, really,
plus, I don't want to eat that stuff, you know?
You don't.
It's a matter of personal integrity and health, right?
Right.
Okay.
But in addition, it's a political problem.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, at
mm-hmm.
some point, we have to say that we're going to have to politically organize.
How come we're not talking about this in the presidential debates?
Well, because the two candidates are, in essence, in the pockets of agribusiness.
Exactly.
I mean, that's how they're able to conduct business. And what they do is they parlay excess capital into political capital. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if you walk through the capital, whether it's Washington, D.C. or in Minnesota, St. Paul, what's the capital?
Des Moines.
Sorry about that. I really tell me my ignorance in geography sometimes. But, you know, here...
It's okay. You know a lot of other things. It's all right.
Thank
Don't
you.
Worry.
Well, that's the thing. We're going to help each other learn things. So that's the point. But, you know, if you look at walk the halls of the actual Capitol buildings, you'll see lobbyists twisting arms. Or you'll see politicians.
We see them on college campuses, too.
Absolutely. Ah. Absolutely. But, you know, if you go to the Capitol and a legislator is running to the hall, they get a notice that there's a bill that's on the floor, and they're running out to go, and the lobbyists will strong-arm them and say, hey, Jonathan, here, you vote like this. And
yeah,
so,
here's what the issues
here's
are.
Here's what
right.
the issues, and this is mm-hmm. what, how you're going to vote.
All right. Now, do you think, for example, Europe, there's been some resistance to GMOs and things like that. Do you think they have a better chance?
Well, you know, in the book, I actually go through some of the WikiLeaks cables around GMOs, and you'll see the extent to which the State Department under Hillary Clinton, among others, really use American political power to impose...
Yeah, it's one of our big exports.
Right. Impose, in essence, act as a arm of agribusiness.
Salesperson.
Exactly. And so...
So what's going to happen then with this Bayer and Monsanto merger? Tell us.
I don't. What can I say? I mean, you know, it reduces increases the power of these companies to be able to impose their model of the world. You know, at the same time, though, bringing in hope if one can at this point.
Oh, please.
There's the notion that despite the fact that they have incredible economic and political power, they're also scared witless. And
that's really good to hear. I can't imagine why they're so arrogant.
Because they're coming up against the limits of their model.
Yeah,
and they know it.
The farmers aren't happy.
The farmers
fancy
aren't,
that they charge a lot of money. They're not getting their money's worth. Yeah. This is not a good business.
The consumers are not happy. The farmers are not happy. In fact, in the book, I describe a listening tour that the Department of Justice and USDA did, a joint listening tour in which they went around the country. And they ended up here in Iowa.
Oh, is this the meat packers one?
Yeah. Well, this is the one about the meat consolidation in the meat sector.
Yeah, and a whole lot happened from that tour, right?
Yeah, well, right. So it failed. However, what the tour showed us is that whether it's farmers here in Iowa, whether it's ranchers in Colorado, whether it's black farmers in Brooklyn, everybody is pissed off at Big Ag. And so Big Ag is bringing America together, and it's a beautiful thing because we're all don't like it.
We're all pissed off at it.
And so you'll see across the board, and also all different political persuasions, whether it's, leftists who are angry at how labor is treated, whether it's, more liberals who are more interested in consumer view vantage point. And there are also more right-wing religious folk who are opposed to, the way that food is handled on religious grounds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I think it really is a means, an opportunity by which people from different backgrounds can come together on a particular issue and really change things in a way, even against a great power like agribusiness.
Let's hope.
And
we're going to end with, here's one of my favorite sayings that I've said for many, many, many years. Arrogance will always overstep itself. Of course, I hope I live to see this one, but, sometimes it takes a long time. So, Rob Wallace, Big Farms Make Big Flu. Thank you very much. We are going to record what he's saying at the library tonight. I don't know when we'll air it, but it's very interesting. Thank you, Rob, for doing this work.
Sure.
Thank you for coming to Ames, and it is really a great pleasure to have this conversation.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay.
Okay.
We are back. This is KHOI Community Radio for the Heart of Iowa, and this is the Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. We've been celebrating the accordion today. You just heard an accordion piece from Austria called
Stradivalzer, and that sort of translates to the turnaround waltz. Accordions, yes. Because this is October. This is Oktoberfest. And believe it or not, right here in central Iowa, there will be a celebration of all things Oktoberfest-y in German.
This Saturday in downtown Ames.
Yes, with, I'm looking forward to this, speaking of accordions, the feature band is going to be Barefoot Becky and the Ivanhoe Dutchman.
And that's at 5 o'clock, right?
Yes, and also, we're going to consider beer a little bit here.
There's going to be lots of beer at the Oktoberfest.
And I have a few little thoughts on beer. It just so happens that our engineer knows a lot about this subject, but to start us off.
Yes, we have a beer head right in the
right
studio.
Right here. Well, all of us are, yes. I want to mention that in 1873, there were 4,131 breweries in this country. In 1932, there were zero. Ooh, bad times for the country. In 1985, there were 110 breweries in the United States. Okay. And when it was counted the last time by the Brewers Association of the United States, in 2015, there were 4,269. So things are looking up.
All right. We are having a resurgence, sort of back to the future or something like that.
So tell us, Evan Taylor has an interest in beer and an interest in what's happening in central Iowa this weekend. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I sure do. Well, first off, I guess I'm always here, but thank you for having me on as a guest. Usually I'm just engineering, but it's always fun to do a little bit of talking. Beer in central Iowa is alive and well. We have so many breweries that are just popping up all over
really,
the place.
Really, really good breweries, I must say.
Incredible breweries. And, of course, Ames is no different. I moved here. We only had one brewery. We have moved up to three with the addition of Torrent and Alluvial on top of Old Main, which we already had. And that's really fantastic. Now, at the Ames Oktoberfest, one thing that we're trying to do is we are trying to celebrate Iowa beer. And we're doing so by having 9 Iowa breweries come for a sampling event and a seasonal style competition, which will be nested into the larger Oktoberfest event.
This sounds so good. Alana and I are going to be there. We are going to belly up to the bar.
Yes. Thank goodness. I would certainly hope so. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, beer is probably the best part of Oktoberfest. Then, of course, you know, polka and food being close second and third. But, oh, goodness, the tradition with beer, it's, you know, it's originally just a marriage of a prince, but it turns into a yearly party. They had so much fun that they decided to keep on doing it.
Very good. So what sort of beers are we going to be able to experience?
Right. Well, at the, again, the sampling event that I've been talking about, we are going to have a litany of Iowa breweries, including...
And this is a contest, too, right?
This is a contest, indeed. We are going to have Old Main Brewing Co. From Ames, also Torrent and Alluvial. And then, in order of how far they are away from us, we are going to have Boone Valley Brewing Company. We're going to have Fire Trucker out of Ankeny, Confluence and Exile out of Des Moines, Kelowna from Kelowna, Iowa, and Millstream from the Amana colonies.
Very good. Sounds yummy.
And it's so wonderful to have beers that can really be tasted, and they're all different. That's really lovely. Why is it that you often have a Oktoberfest beer or a Harvestfest beer? What are brewers trying to celebrate with that? Is there a certain kind of something in the air that's supposed to make them taste different?
Well, you know, I think part of it is just the German brewing tradition. Making those Märzen lagers is just really part of Oktoberfest, part of this party that's been going on for years and years now. Over 200, if I'm correct. But I think that there's also just something really, really pleasant about the roasty toastiness of the beers that you get in autumn, as opposed to those that are incredibly hoppy in the summer and those that are very dark and heavy on the palate that you have in the winter.
Oh, so tell me about lagers. It's the lagers that are celebrated.
To some extent, yes. Lagers are, you know, they're really interesting. The difference between a lager and a yale, and an ale, excuse me, is mostly the yeast that's used. The one is a top fermenting yeast, and the other is a bottom fermenting yeast. The brewing process is a little bit different in terms of how you, well, not the brewing process, the fermentation process. Lagers are typically fermented at a lower temperature, so they fit in really well to those colder months because before we had, you know, refrigeration systems, it made it a lot easier to produce these beers.
And did you say we're going to actually have some special German beers brought in to Ames for this occasion?
That is correct. We are going to have a variety of German beers that we
in
are going to have
to
available.
In addition to our local show?
That's correct, yeah. For the retail side of things, we actually have five beers total. Four of them are going to be imported, German imports. We are going to have the Franziskaner Hefeweizen. We are going to have the Polliner Pilsner, the Vorsteiner Oktoberfest, and a personal favorite, the Spaten Optimator, which is a very
the
delicious.
The Spaten Optimator! Dunkel. That just rolls right off your tongue, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And it's,
what's it taste like, Kevin?
Oh, tell us. Oh, tell
oh,
us.
Oh, my gosh. It's a Dunkel, so it's
a
it's
Dunkel?
Very, yes, yeah. It's dark. It's toasty. It has a lot of full body to it. It's
oh boy,
it's
we got to try that.
Relatively high ABV too, so you know, enjoy in moderation.
People drink it and dance, I guess.
Exactly. That's it'll help you get your polka pants on.
We will. We will. Oh, it's so wonderful to have someone with a nice palate. You were telling me that in wine parlance, there's the sommelier as the wine guy, but
the person who knows what they're doing. Right?
Yes, but there's
the trained
there is a beer person. There's a name for that.
Yes, absolutely. There is a beer equivalent to the sommelier. It's a it is a cicerone and
a cicerone.
Cicerone, yes, which is. Basically, what you do is you can get certified through several courses the same way that you would get certified to be a sommelier. This certification comes through the BJCP, which is the Beer Judge Certification Program.
This is American?
Or
international?
It is currently an international organization, but it was originally founded in 1985 by the American Homebrewers Association as a way to have more objective method of judging beers and learning about beers. And they publish a style guide in order to kind of understand what you're looking for in your ideal IPA, your ideal stout, and so on and so forth. And it's really the gold standard right now that's used in the large beer competitions that you hear about. For instance, Great American Beer Fest, which was quite recently in Colorado, and other World Beer Cups. Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. And there's going to be official judges at the event on Main Street.
Who have official certifications, who are trained to
Yeah,
judge,
that's right. Yes, we are going to have a panel of judges to determine the best seasonal beer within the local sampling event. Three of our judges are actually going to be coming from the Ames Brewers League, which is our local homebrew club, very active, alive, and well. They meet once a month at Torrent Brewing Company. And those three actually have some experience and some certification within the BJCP program. Our fourth judge is kind of going to be at large. It's going to be Adam Bremmeyer, local manager of DG's Tap House. And he knows a thing or two about beer since they have that massive tap box with 56 beers on tap. So he's going to be a wonderful addition to round everything out.
Good. We are going to look forward to Oktoberfest this weekend.
It starts at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So you got all day to sip and sample.
Oh, absolutely. You got about 8 or 9 hours to make it happen. Definitely.
So enjoy. Also this weekend, Ames Farmers Market's going on downtown. They're going to be in there.
But we're near the end of the season,
yep.
So.
And it's going to be in the Wheatsfield Co-op parking lot as opposed to on Main Street. Give them time to set up.
Yes, so get right down there and get your horseradish. And what other sorts of things do you think will be?
Oh, pumpkins and garlic.
Oh,
and
yes.
And okay. also coming up this Saturday, when you're tasted all the beer, when you've poked it around to Barefoot Becky, well, you can also 7 o'clock that evening, October 22nd, come to the Central Iowa Barn Dance. Dance to the Barn Owl Band. There may be some Halloween-y sort of dances we will do. It'll be a good time.
Come, are you calling?
Come, yes, come and contra dance. That will be a lot of fun. It's always a good time. We teach you everything you need to know, and you get to dance with your neighbors. So, do that. That's very good. Also, I want to mention that KHOI has a new show called Polka Time. If you can't get enough of this stuff, Saturday and Sunday. Sunday at 6:30. It's on Saturday, too. Look for Polka Time. Why not? That's a good thing. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. Thank you for joining us. You heard an interview with Dr. Rob Wallace. Good job, Donna. Good job. And we had accordion music. And we learned about beer from Evan Taylor.
And more beer this weekend. Come on down.
Everyone can use a polka. Yes, yes. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
This is the Donalana Kitchen. We had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.